Hello. Hey, so welcome to, as Daryl said, to the 10 a.m. service here at Waverly Belmont Elementary. My name is Ben. I'm on staff as a pastor with Daryl and a few others, fellow imposters. And so we are kind of this, we're in the second week of our sermon series in the book of John. And we'll be kind of slowly marching through it. We won't bullet train through it. We're going to go from start to finish. And so we'll end up finishing around September, October, somewhere in there, as we kind of week by week explore John's take and perception and reality of who Jesus is and what that means. And so we're dealing with kind of the theme of a misunderstood Messiah, as Jesus marks, his life is marked with misunderstanding. And so this morning, we're kind of in a familiar passage in John 2, and it's the wedding at Cana, water to wine. You can be in church your whole life, and you know it, and you have questions about it, probably. And yes, it was real wine. It wasn't Welch's. You don't have to grow up in the church to know what this is. Like, there's a familiarity culturally with this story. And so this morning, we're going to explore this story. And sometimes when you're familiar with the story, that's one of the harder ones to grab hold of, because you can just, you know what's coming. You can read the plot, and you're so ingrained and it's enveloping that the expectation is just there. And sometimes the surprise and wonder can be lost. And so this morning, kind of my hope is we can rediscover the majesty and the wonder of it. And I was kind of reading through it this week and thinking through it, and really what this passage is, it's kind of the last dance. If you've seen the Netflix series on Michael Jordan and the Bulls, if you haven't, go watch it. It's incredible. But basically, this is the last dance kind of passage, in the sense of it deals with one main figure. But there's a million storylines and angles and really important details that we could spend hours and hours delving into, and we can't this morning. But my hope is that kind of this morning we discover the wonder and the majesty of John 2. And so Jesus's first sign, his first miracle, John's kind of composition of his gospel is there's no birth narrative, there's no childhood stories. He just jumps in. And that's last week we heard about the Word, and the Word was God, was with God, and just the freight train and the Brinks truck that is of goodness. And John goes from there, of a big theological pound cake, into a story of Jesus kicking into gear in his ministry here in John 2. And so if this is Jesus' first sign, his first miracle, right off the bat here at the wedding in Cana, let's hold that in tension with another fact that we hold true, which is this. Jesus is eternal. Jesus has always existed in eternity in the fellowship with the Father and the Spirit and this triune Godhead. So let's hold the fact that this is his first sign and he's existed for eternity. If you put those two things together, wouldn't it make sense that Jesus has been waiting all eternity for this one sign? Like, he's been waiting it with bated breath. Like, I cannot wait to do this first miracle. I can't wait for them to see and to show them what I'm like. And this first sign is a water to wine at a wedding in Nowhereville, Cana. And for us, it's a story that's really, the goal is for this story to grab us, because this story is our story. Because this wedding at Cana really does reflect kind of our own wedding, our own love story with Jesus, and what that relationship is like, and the kind of bridegroom he is, as we, his people, are his bride. And so, with that in mind, let's read John 2. You can open, if you have a Bible, or it's on the screen behind me. But John 2, John writes this story of the wedding at Cana. And it's this. It says, "On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples." It's a classic plus one, plus 12. "And when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.' And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come.' His mother said to the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.' Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast.' So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become the wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, the bridegroom, everyone serves the good wine first. And when people have, you can hear the slurred nature of this speech, but everyone served the good wine first. And when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you, bridegroom, you have kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. And his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples. And they stayed there for a few days. This is God's word in John 2. So, John jumps into the ministry of Jesus, the life of Jesus, and we're here with his few disciples that have been called. He's ready to go in the blocks. He's at this wedding, and we see here in that day and age, engagements would have been about a year long, which we all can agree is a terrible idea. But in that year long, the engagement was that long because of this, because they had to prepare for this feast, this party, this wedding. That betrothal actually was gathering all the resources and all the payments for the ability to kind of give this gift to the family of the bride, and also to prepare this ceremony. A year long working toward this one event. And this one event wasn't just an evening or an afternoon. This one event was actually 7 days long. And if you're really wealthy, it would have been even longer. A week-long party, a week-long wedding, a week-long festivity, a week-long feast here in Cana. And so what the writer of John, he tells us, there is a week-long party, we're 3 days into it, it's not even halfway done yet, and something happens, they run out of wine. That all the things they've prepped for a whole entire year, they've gotten ready for the moment, they've done a very poor job at, because halfway through it, they're out of the wine. And an important piece of ancient Near East wedding is you got to give the people what they want. You got to give them wine. You got to make sure they keep drinking. The big no-no happens, because it's not just inconvenient of, hey, there's no more sauce. It's not just embarrassing of, hey, we've kind of miscalculated numbers. What's happening here is humongous. Right, Tiger King says it well. I will never recover from this. That's what the people who've thrown this wedding, which would have been the groom and his family, would be thinking. The reality of running out of wine, they can never recover from. Because this is a cul-de-sac moment. They've gone a year in prepping, they've run out. They've gone to the cellar, there's nothing there. They maybe have maybe gone to the neighbors, though they probably didn't, because that's risky and shameful, and they would have gone and asked them, do you have anything? Lend me some wine, I am your neighbor. Like, they would have wanted it, and to the point in which even the guest of the wedding kicked it into gear, Mary, and she now is trying to fix the problem. And so with all of that scene set in mind, one word describes the scenario here at the wedding in Cana, and it's the word of empty. Emptiness describes the reality for them at the wedding in Cana. And to think that emptiness is just because they have no wine is missing something, because it's not just the quantity of wine that's empty. Actually, we have to look at the story underneath the story of seeing what it was like for them to be empty. So what's the layers of emptiness in this story for them? So one reality of emptiness for them is that it's inadequate. They have thrown an inadequate party. And that day, they didn't provide enough for their people. They've come up short. And in that day, what would have happened is this. A short supply and no wine, planning poorly, being an adequate party would have meant you are an adequate host. What the party is, it reflects just upon the host. What the party's like is what you are like, inadequate. An emptiness piece, a layer beneath that is this, indicting. Because actually what happens in the social circles of that day, if you don't have enough wine, it's socially shaming, right? It's the talk of the town. the highest of party fouls. That's just the floor, because here's the ceiling of the moment of having no wine. They could have, and actually would have, and should have been brought to court, because what happened in that day is this. You gathered people together, and you just committed the biggest social no-no of having no wine. We're taking you to court. It's inadequate. They're indicting. It's also this. The reality of emptiness for them is isolating. They can't go over the loudspeaker and say, hey, so we made a snafu and we've run out of wine, but hey, we're going to ride it. Y'all just keep partying, keep hanging out, just hold tight. They can't say that. And it's isolating because of this. It's isolating because they have to hold the news and the reality of what they've done. And that boulder sits in their backpack that no one else can fix and no one else knows. Have you ever held news about someone else, but certainly about yourself, that no one else can know about? How lonely is it? And lastly, one thing about emptiness is this in the story for these people who have thrown this party and messed up is that there's an insecurity about the moment. Because all of a sudden, the fragility of the moment has rubbed off on other people to the point in which Mary, a guest, is trying to help them. The moment for them of emptiness is marked with this: inadequacy, indictingness, the potential of being indicted, isolation, and insecurity. That's what the moment's marked by. Can I ask a quick question? What does the voice of shame sound like? Does the voice of shame, is it marked by these things, by the voice of inadequacy, by the voice of indictment, of looming pressure, the voice of isolation that you're all alone, the voice of insecurity that nothing is stable in your world? That for them, in this story, in this setting, the voice of shame is stoking the fire because they're empty. And therefore, they're being inadequate. They're being seen as worthy of indictment. They're being seen as isolated. They're being seen as insecure. They're carrying all that themselves. The reality of emptiness really does emanate because the voice of shame in their life and in their head and their world is emanating. It's growing. Now for us, if this happened in our day, in modern world, we just go to Frugal McDougal's. Right, we just go and fix this problem, and the party would go on. So the question is, why does this kind of shortage of wine in their world have to do with our world? What's the connection? It's a story that happens, but how does their story mess or even touch our own story? So, picture the scene with me. Like, I want you to think of this setting, John 2. You can even close your eyes if you want to. You don't have to. Okay, so this wedding, it's a week-long party. I mean, it's a year in coming. They've waited for this thing for a whole entire year, and it's a week-long party. Wouldn't you be excited for it? Like, you would have blocked off your schedule for it. It would have been the event you've been waiting for. And so I think there is plenty of loud noise, plenty of partying happening. There's plenty of stimulation happening. You're there to have a good time. And there's probably even overstimulation happening of all your people together in your village, in your kind of circles. You're there with them, loud, having all the food, all the drink. Everyone is there to have one thing, a celebratory great time. And amid that kind of a swell of the moment that you see as you look around, in that moment, there's one person walking around with an emptiness that's marked with inadequacies, indictments, isolations, and insecurities. That's the scene that we see here. Nashvillians, can you describe to me a city? Just think of any city that's marked with this, that's marked with the loudness and a stimulation and where people go to for a good time, and yet in that swell of a city that there's people walking around with emptiness inside of them. It's not Bowling Green, just to answer the question for you. That maybe this moment here in 2026 in Nashville mimics that moment in first century Cana. that the ability to actually be normalized of walking around with emptiness that sounds like inadequacy, indictment, isolation, and insecurity very well may be normal to the human experience. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves before we kind of march our way through this story of emptiness is we have to ask ourselves and pinpoint in ourselves, where might there be emptiness? So the question for us is, where are you running on empty? Where are you running on empty? Just like this groom and his family was running on empty. It could be places you've lost things. You could have lost friendships. You could have lost routines. You could have lost opportunities. You could have lost jobs. You could be empty from deaths. Certainly death of people, but even death of a dream. You could be empty from just transitions of life that have just taken a bite out of you. You could be empty from confusion. Like you can't make sense of the season of life you're in or the one you're coming out of, you're going into. You could be empty from being hungry because you want something. Actually, it hurts to want something. It's costly to want something. You could be empty and your tank could be low because of relationships that have just been a lot for you, or you could be empty and low because you don't have that relationship that you most want. You could be empty because emotionally you're just spent. The bucket is poured out. Or you could be empty emotionally because you're just feeling so misunderstood and isolated. You can go on and on of the places and the tanks in which emptiness is marked by in our world. And this story in John 2 is trying to tell us and show us the reality of being human is to have tanks that really do run empty. If anything, the story of the Bible tells us of emptiness that's been filled up. Everything from the garden onward. And so we need to pinpoint and do the hard work of asking ourselves, where are we running on empty? Now, about 3.5 years ago, my wife and I had about a week off, and so we decided, let's go to Florida, because that's just what people do. But she's from Florida. And so we went to Florida, and we began to have this kind of caravan tour of seeing her family and friends, and it was a great time. And we had 2 kids at the time, not 4 like we do now, so life was just easy. And so we went down, packed them in the car, and amid this caravan, sleeping in a different bed every night as we were just kind of visiting friends, and we decided we wanted to take a second mortgage out on our house, so we wanted to go to Disney World. So we took a second mortgage out on our house for 1 day at Disney World, and we went to Disney World and woke up at around 6 o'clock at somebody's house. They live 2 hours from Orlando. So we woke up, drove to Orlando, and we're kind of in this this hard, terrible city called Orlando, and we're going. We find ourselves into Disney World, and finally we make our way like cattle through a trough to our parking lot, which is not right by Disney World. It's actually in Alabama, so you then have to go and hop on a tram, and you go on a tram with your kind of with your backpack and your stroller, and you go, and then you have to walk the pilgrimage to the front gate, and you finally get in the front gate, and you've made it into Disney World, and that's where the real adventure begins, because August in Orlando isn't real nice. It's the sun blisters you like an ant with a magnifying glass. Like, so at that day, just to get to the gate, I started the day at a -2. And if you can imagine, Disney World doesn't fill your tank up. Actually, it draws and makes these deposits and these pull withdrawals on a negative balance that you already have. So all of a sudden, I was at a -2, trying to make my way through Disney World, and end of the day at -10, let's say. Empty. I was empty. My tank was empty. But if you saw me on that day amid my -2 and kind of teetering down to a -10, you would have seen, oh boy, this guy is marked with emptiness. Like, he's got nothing in the tank. And I knew that I was kind of petering lower and lower and lower, and the gas gauge was getting lower and lower. Amid that emptiness, would it make sense to you that the shame story that I deal with of being a second-rate dad, do you think that that story kicked in when I'm with my kids at the place of wonder as a curmudgeon? Because oftentimes, the places that we are most empty, the places where we're just run dry and run empty and run ragged, oftentimes those are the places where the shame stories and beliefs begin to creep in. And because we're empty, we begin to believe things about ourselves. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do, to answer where am I empty and what are the shame stories and headlines I'm believing. But what I am saying is they're worthwhile asking. And they're worth digging into to find answers of. Because here in this story, emptiness doesn't stay in a neat, tidy box of wine, because the voice of shame kicks in the places that are most empty. And what's true in John 2 probably is true in 2026. So, one beautiful, powerful thing, though, about this story is that amid that emptiness, amid that tank being low, amid the shame stories, they got to Jesus. Because if they didn't have those, the wedding would have happened. It would have been a fine, good wedding. It would have been on with life. And yet what we see here, John wants to tell us this story to show us, amid that emptiness, they get to Jesus. And so Jesus' interest is piqued, not with the problem of emptiness at hand, but the reality of this story is Jesus' interest is piqued in the people that bring him the problem of emptiness. Because here, he looks and talks and engages with Mary, and we have to grab hold of what their conversation looked like. So Mary goes to Jesus, and she says to him the powerful words of this: there is no more wine. Hey, Jesus, in verse 3, we've got no more wine. Kind of the wedding's happening. We got 4 more days of partying, and we are out of supplies. In verse 3, she goes to him with a problem. And in verse 5, she says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Now, those are two different phrases. Hey, we got a problem. And then she says, do whatever he tells you. In verse 3 and verse 5, which means this: something happened in their exchange that made her go from, I'm freaking out about a problem, to, do whatever he tells you. Let him solve this. I trust him. What happened between those two words of Mary? Look at me in verse 3 and 4 about what Jesus says. We have no more wine. And Jesus says to Mary, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. Now, at first glance, this doesn't look good for Jesus. We can all agree with that. Right, because with modern ears and modern eyes and modern sensibilities, we hear him say, woman, and we hear him say to Mary, hey, mom, watch yourself. Like, simmer down. Know your place. Easy, tiger. Like, he's dismissing her. That's what our modern ears hear when we hear this. And yet, it couldn't be more opposite. It couldn't be more opposite. Because here, he's not saying these kind of exclamatory words at his mom. He's saying these empathetic words to her. Because in that day, to say woman to someone is not shaming. To say woman to her would be dignifying, personal. To say woman to her would have been connecting. It's like this. It's like, has someone ever gotten down on your level and looked right in your eyes and said the words you really needed to hear that made you more free? That's what's happening here. Jesus gets on her level and connects with her in such a way that he dignifies her. And in such a way that actually she's able to go from, we've got a problem, Houston, to, I trust you. Because he connects with her and he gets on her level and eye contactedly says, woman. It'd be like this: Carl, Caitlin, Lane. He connects with the person, not simply trying to address the problem. The story of John 2 tells us that Jesus is hungry and ready and wanting to connect with the people, not just the problems that we have. His main agenda is not correcting the problem, but connecting with the people. And therefore, Mary goes from kind of white-knuckling a problem to open-handedly giving it over to Jesus because she trusts him. Because of one dignifying word that disarms her, woman. One dignifying word that disarms her. One of my favorite movies is 1997 called Good Will Hunting. It's a great movie. If you haven't watched it, go watch it. They're watching it, I think, in Kid Town downstairs. But how about them apples? So in this movie, Matt Damon is this whiz of a kid in Boston, kind of this rough and tumble roots of Boston, and he is a janitor at MIT. Well, it turns out that Matt Damon is a genius. He's wicked smart. So he goes and he actually can solve all these mathematical problems. And he's there at MIT, and all of a sudden, one professor at MIT discovers this janitor is a whiz. He has a high ceiling of potential. Actually, I think he could win the Fields Medal of math stuff. And so this math professor says, I want to take you under my wing. I want to just your potential to be reached. And so he's kind of in the classroom doing his thing, but it turns out, actually, he's got a checkered past. In fact, it's more than just that. He kind of has this backpack full of trauma from his growing up that is horrific and hard. And so, actually, this math professor says, hey, I'll deal with the classroom stuff, and I'm going to actually bring someone else in, Sean McGuire, who's played by Robin Williams. I'm going to bring him in to deal with the counseling stuff, the heart stuff. And so Matt Damon all of a sudden is having kind of this high ceiling being set, and they want him to reach it. He's feeling the pressure of it. So he's doing all this classroom stuff. He's doing this counseling stuff. And really the movie is about what's happening in that counseling room in the heart of Matt Damon. And in the heart of Matt Damon, he's kind of doing circles and skating around Robin Williams, just toying with him. But finally, they kind of become closer and closer through real, honest, earnest conversations. And finally, towards the end of the movie, Robin Williams, who is the counselor, named Sean McGuire in the movie, looks in his office with Matt Damon, Will Hunting, and he looks at Matt Damon, this whiz kid, and he says, I got your file right here that the court gave me, and it has things like his birthday and factoids about his kind of growing up, but also has pictures, and pictures of how he was abused as a boy in the foster care system. And he says, he's looking at it, and Matt Damon says, you ever seen stuff like that, Doc? And he says, yeah, I've seen a lot in my 20 years of counseling. And he's like, no, have you seen that? He's like, yeah, I have. And they begin to exchange stories of abuse as children, as what it looked like to be wailed upon by their dads, their foster parents. And all of a sudden, Robin Williams closes the folder as they've connected over this bond that no one should share ever. And he looks at Will Hunting. He looks at Matt Damon. And Sean McGuire, Robin Williams, says to Matt Damon, this whiz kid, see all this? All the things, all the abuse that you have had, been a victim of, he says, it's not your fault. And Matt Damon kind of says, yeah. Robin Williams says, it's not your fault. Matt Damon says, yeah, I know. He says, it's not your fault. And he kind of begins to inch closer to him, takes steps. He says, yeah, I know, it's not my fault. He says, no, Will, it's not your fault. And he doesn't know what to do with this. And Robin Williams says it again, it's not your fault. And Matt Damon's like, stop it. He says, it's not your fault. And over again, he says it. Finally, to the point in which Matt Damon pushes him away, Robin Williams says it again, it's not your fault. And finally, they hug and embrace in tears. A dignifying word that disarms a person. The word that actually they most needed to hear in the problem of their pain, in the problem of their emptiness. A dignifying word that disarms them. What did Mary hear in John 2? A dignifying word that disarms her. Friends, what dignifying word do you need to hear from the Jesus of John 2 that actually speaks and looks toward you in your state now and speaks to you a dignifying word that speaks to the emptiness that you may be carrying, that disarms you? Disarms you in your emptiness, disarms you in your shame. It's not an easy question to answer, but maybe a hint of where it is and what it could sound like is, where are you looking to be Jesus? Where you're being invited to let him be him. And let him in, and actually go like Mary did, go from a white-knuckle hold to an open-handed trust. with one disarming word that's dignifying. Because it's in that disarmed place, it's in the place of emptiness where Jesus does his best work of filling us up. And that's what the story in John 2 tells us. The problem is fixed. There's emptiness, and it ends with fullness. And Jesus in John 2 goes on to right the ship, bring the remedy. And what happens is he goes from taking the problem on that Mary says, do what he says, and he takes not the old wineskins where the wine would have been for the party. He actually says, hey, don't go there, servants. Here's what I want you to do. Servants, go to the stone jars by the entrance of the party and take those things and fill them up to the brim. That's where you're going to draw wine from, those stone jars. It says a Jewish rites of purification. Go to those vessels, a Jewish rites of purification, and fill those up. Because actually, those Jewish rites of purification did this. If you wanted to be inside the wedding, here's what you had to do. You were dirty outside the wedding. You had traveled there. You're filthy. And you'd go to those stone jars, and you'd go and you wash yourself so that you could go inside the wedding to be a perfect, pure guest of the wedding party. And does it make sense that Jesus would take the things in which that are meant, the vehicles that are meant to make you pure and whole, and to go from outside the party to inside the party, that he takes those things and he says, drink the things that I provide in those things so that you can go from outside the party to inside the party. What is this we're about to do up here with the bread and the wine? These are the stone jars that take us from outside the party to inside the party, that will wash us clean. Because here, he takes the stone jars and he fills them up and he takes a cup and draws a cup and takes it to the master of the feast. And the master of the feast takes a drink of this. And again, 3 days into the party, he's having a good time. And he says, bring me the groom. And the groom is brought to him. And here's what he says to the groom. The master of the feast says, everyone serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you, groom, you have kept the good wine until now. The master of the feast's paradigms are blown. He's astounded by the quality. It's so good. And he's so excited for the days to come because he says, this groom has given the best he had till now. This groom here makes the party great, everything's okay and perfect, the story goes on. We need to ask a question. Who gets all the benefit of the provision of the good wine? Master of the feast said, you, groom, you have kept the good wine until now. The one who benefits from the provision of the best wine is the one who created the problem of having no wine in the first place. The one who gets all the credit is the one who made the problem itself. The misunderstood Messiah doesn't take credit for what he's doing at this wedding because his eyes are always on his own wedding. His eyes are always on the one he is marching toward, his people. Because in John 2, he tells his mom, hey, it's not my time yet. It's not my time to go and kick into gear. Because actually he's seeing wine at a wedding and he can't not see his own blood. It's not my time yet. And in John 2, actually, he says, hey, woman, it's not my time yet, because actually there's only one other time that he will say to his mom, woman. And it's in John 19 when he's on the cross, when his time has come, and he looks down from the cross and he says, woman, look at your son. And in John 2, he can't see wine in a wedding and not think of his own wedding, of how he will provide wine, and that wine is his own blood. Who gets the benefit from his provision? The one who created the problem, the one who is there empty, gets filled up. Friends, this very day, it's important for us to pinpoint the emptiness we have, because actually we see a Jesus who's ready to fill us up. And in fact, that emptiness that we feel is the entrance into our own wedding. The emptiness we feel, the misunderstood Messiah wants to provide abundantly for it because he's wild about us, his people. Let's pray. Jesus, give us courage and clarity to do the hard work of seeing where we're empty right now, and naming those places and holding them and bringing them to you and also naming the shame stories that are in our life and bringing them to you. But Jesus, I pray that we do those things courageously after we believe and are beheld by the glory that the beloved Son would come to us and pour himself out for us and provide abundantly for us, those who are empty. Jesus, may this story go from a story in a book to our own story, that we would see ourselves as your beloved. We are yours, and our beloved, you are ours. May the story grab us as our own story, so that then we can come to you and be filled up. We pray this, Christ, in your name, the one who took empty things and made it full. Amen.